The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I'm tempted to want to add a lot of what we're talking about around the edges here to the actual tape lecture, but probably should try to resist that. Let me just emphasize it again, that as far as I see the biblical teaching, with every one of these mysteries, what happens again and again, in whatever form, the attempt is made to deny one or the other of the twin truths that go into making it a mystery. And somebody was saying that Professor Frame would not want to remove sin from that whatsoever that God has foreordained, and I was just reminding that I certainly don't either. And that's what I said at that point. Sin is not outside that bound. But if, on the other hand, you were to suggest, well, the way to come to greater clarity is to say it's just theological rhetoric to say God's not the author of sin, and God really is responsible for the sin, I would say me genoito, or some emotional kind of response. May it never be, because it's not. Biblically, it is blasphemous to bring God into the picture as the one who is responsible for sin. The Scriptures never allow man to point to God and say, "You're responsible, God." Somehow, some way. And this language about God's not the author of sin, language about God permitting the first sin, all of that, henaus, out of here with that. I would say that's only, I'm afraid, from my perspective, an attempt to play down the mystery by denying that aspect of it. As I was saying to somebody walking up to class, I've always found it interesting that the Westminster Confession of Faith, when it talks about providence and talks about God ordaining whatever comes to pass, makes the statement it's not by a bare permission. And I understand what they're saying. They're saying you can't simply use a term like permission, bare permission, to have God not ordaining it. God's sort of standing on the sidelines and he lets it happen kind of thing. Okay, I understand what they're saying. Then, interestingly enough, when you get to, what is it, chapter 6, and the same divines of Westminster have to talk about the fall of man, they now talk about God permitting it. So that it seems to me what I get out of that is that even they are forced, because of the mystery, to find some word other than God did it. And interestingly enough, they even use the word permit. Okay, back to where we were in the discussion. If I can remember where it was before the tape broke down on us, I was saying something to this effect, that a tension always exists for our thinking when we try to put together, reconcile rationally and totally, those twin truths of God's foreordination of whatever comes to pass, and our being the only, underline only, responsible agent in regard to our sin. This tension exists, of course, in the case of every sin, but it concerns us here, and perhaps most dramatically, as we consider the very first sin of man. What I've wanted to say at that point, I think I've already said in a way. Let's look at a couple of biblical texts now. Think of the way in which that double volume, Luke-Acts, speaks, for example, with regard to the arch crime of human history, which is surely the crucifixion of the Lord of glory. Remember how Paul uses that language in 1 Corinthians 2:8. If the princes of this world had realized what they were doing, even they would have been kept from it. They crucified the Lord of glory. Peter, on the day of Pentecost, speaks, you remember, to the assembled throngs concerning Jesus the Nazarene. And he says in Acts 2, verse 23, "This man delivered up by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men, and you put him to death. Now notice how strong the language is there. In the original Greek text, we read, Te horizmene boule kai prognose tu theou. And that term, horizo, means to fix determinatively. I think that's probably the definition you get in Bauer's lexicon. To fix determinatively. The RSV tries to carry the force of it by translating, according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. This crucifixion happened according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. The NIV has it, by God's set purpose and foreknowledge. So you've noticed that on the one hand. But notice also that the men who put our Lord to death are not in any shape, fashion, or form by the fact of God's sovereign foreordination excused and without guilt. Or with a lessened guilt, by no means. They are expressly charged here by Peter with being anomon. The NIV translates wicked. Literally, it would be lawless. In doing that, they were lawless. They were wicked. So you've got both of the truths in the very same verse. And Peter doesn't then get into a philosophical explanation of it. He just sets it before us. Now look at Acts 4, verses 27 and 28. For truly in this city they are gathered together against thy holy servant Jesus, whom thou didst anoint, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever thy hand and thy purpose predestined to occur. The Greek there in verse 28 is poiesai hosa he ker sukai he bulesu proorison genestai. They came to do, not in their minds was their intention, but this is what they were doing, whatever God's hand and God's purpose predestined to occur. Oh, okay, Herod's off the hook then. Pontius Pilate's one of the best servants God ever had. Not Peter's point, okay? Read it in the context. They're not off the hook. Look back at the Gospel of Luke, chapter 22, verse 22. Paul's imagined objector in Romans 9, or that student I mentioned from Messiah College, might have suggested that if the cross of Christ was a central element in God's eternal plan of redemption, then Judas Iscariot was one of the greatest servants God ever had. I expect Judas Iscariot, he might say, to get one of the greatest rewards. I mean, where would we be without the act of betrayal? Just as Pharaoh, that objector is suggesting in Romans 9, should be called a commendable witness to God's power. But what does our Lord say here? Does he perhaps deny God's sovereign foreordination of the crucifixion and thus of the betrayal? Not at all. He affirms it here, Luke 22, 22. Okay, then, perhaps he exonerates on that basis Judas. God's not the author of sin. That's just a reform cliche. Let's go to the root of Gordon Clark or somebody and say that really when you get right down to it, we know where sin originates. No, not that. Certainly not to exonerate Judas. Rather, you see here, he pronounces divine judgment upon him for his heinous crime. Reading it at last. For indeed the Son of Man is going as it has been determined. Kata ta harasmenon. But woe to that man through whom he is betrayed. So, we're left with the mystery of how sin can come to exist in a universe absolutely controlled by an all-holy God. But the twin truths that yield that mystery are truths that we need to know, believe, take seriously, if we're going to understand our responsibility and our relation to our God. Now, secondly, That first question accented a how at the beginning of it. How can this be? The second one, capital B, is the mystery of why. For what possible reason? An all-wise, all-holy, all-loving, all-powerful God, why should such a God foreordain the entrance of sin into the race? Now, certainly we must say that God decreed it to manifest His own glory, because that's the purpose of all God's decrees. Just think of the way that's stated in Romans 9, verses 22 and 23. And sometimes students think, okay, we've answered it then. No mystery there. But you see, there's still the question of why God should have chosen this particular way of exhibiting the riches of His glory. Surely God could have decreed not to allow sin entrance, to suggest otherwise, to imagine otherwise, to say, oh no, this had to be, is to make sin necessary to God's purposes and thus lessen sin's sinfulness. If it's necessary somehow to reflect God's glory, well, then it's not so bad after all. No, the reason behind God's decree has not been revealed to us, and it is not ours to try to understand why. In the following passage, Machen begins by emphasizing the truths that we underscored in our capital A. Then he takes up this why question of our point B. And finally, he provides a nice transition to our third mystery, point C. So let me share this with you from one of Machen's radio sermons. I say that because I always find it kind of interesting to reflect on the kind of sermons you could get away with in an earlier day when people had more Bible knowledge and background and whatever. These are popular messages. They're not exactly the style of popular messages of our day. It's a good book to read. It's called The Christian View of Man. And it's a collection of this series of radio sermons that Machen preached over radio station WIP in Philadelphia, which is still one of the leading stations there, I think. This is on pages 192, 193, and I quote, "When we say that man had free will and that he chose the way of death, we do not mean that his choice was outside the eternal plan of God. We do not mean that he surprised God when he sinned. On the contrary, the eternal plan of God, as we saw when we dealt with God's decrees, embraces all things that come to pass. Even the sin of man was brought to pass in accordance with the counsel of God's will. But, as we observed when we dealt with that subject, God brings to pass different things in widely different ways. So He brought to pass the fall of man in a way that preserved to the full man's personal freedom and man's responsibility. God is not the author of sin. The tempter and man himself were the authors of man's sin." I wouldn't even put it quite that way. I would say man was the author and the tempter was the tempter. But okay, going on. "God's righteousness is forever pure. Yet God used even that terrible evil for His own holy purpose. He permitted man to fall. Do not ask me why He did so." See, now he's moving to the why question, capital B. "I cannot tell you. That is the eternal mystery of evil. It is to us an insoluble riddle. We must trust God alone for the solution of it. One thing, however, is clear. Man had no excuse when he fell. He was guilty in the sight of God. Being left to the freedom of his own will, he fell from the estate wherein he was created by sinning against God." Now that last sentence opens up to us. Oh, there are the page numbers, in case you need those. That last sentence opens up to us the third of these mysteries arising from the fact of the fall. If, as Machen says, being left to the freedom of his own will, he fell from the estate wherein he was created by sinning against God, how can you explain that he ever sinned? The third mystery, capital C, is how can a being who is holy become unholy in the free exercise of his own will? Now, I'm sure you'll remember that when we were discussing the original condition of Adam as he came from the Creator, we insisted that the Scripture witness is that he was not simply not sinful, not simply neutrally innocent, neither good nor bad, but positively holy. Now, the problem is how sin could gain a foothold in the heart of such a holy being. Granted, the temptation certainly was present. Still, what would there be in the heart of a holy being to which that temptation would appeal? What would there be which would respond to the temptation? Now, in your reading assignments, I can't always remember what's part of the assignments and what isn't. So let me just say that in Anthony Hookham's book, he deals with this under the title, The Riddle of Sin. Here's another word, problem, mystery, antinomy, riddle. The Riddle of Sin, pages 130 to 132. See, Reformed theologians are always striving to be original so they can get published. And the only way to be original is change the word, right? Come up with riddle, okay. Blochet, on pages 145 and 146, says this, why did they yield? I'm quoting Blochet. The enigma remains total. There's another word. Enigma. Boy, I didn't realize that there's so many we could use. Why did they yield? The enigma remains total and the evil rebellion inexcusable. The reason, of course, is that the Bible teaches us, we've said it before, that all actions of man find their source and motive in his heart. That is, in the innermost recesses of his being. How could a sinful act arise out of the heart and will of a holy being? We have to say, I think, that this sin was, in the deepest sense, an irrationality. There was no reason for it. And after all, sin is the extreme irrationality. John Laidlaw, on page 359 of the original edition of the Bible Doctrine of Man, quotes this passage from John Duncan, and I quote it also now. I gave you the page. As to its essence and its origin, beyond this that I have said, it always seems to me that our speculations are directed to find the rationale of the only irrational thing in the universe, and of the only thing that has no cause. Suppose sin to have a cause. Well, is not that causal volition of the creature a sin, equally, with all that follows from it? If so, whence came it? In other words, he's saying you just push it back. Whence came it? From God? Sounds like me here. The next words are, me genuito. If not from God, whence? From naught. From nothing. It is causeless and irrational. It is monstrosity. A thing horrible in a God-made universe just because it is causeless. Another one who writes on the subject in an interesting way is W.G.T. Shedd in his Dogmatic Theology, Volume 2, on page 156, and I quote, hence the origin of sin has somewhat of the characteristic of a caprice. It was not a natural or a rational act, but unnatural and irrational. Sin is the mystery of iniquity. And he has that in quotation marks because he's using Paul's phrase. The fall of man cannot be rationalized. That is, it can't be explained on natural and rational grounds. This would require that it be accounted for, not by pure self-determination, but by the operation of the law of cause and effect. There was no prior sinful act or sinful inclination of Adam by which to account for the fact of his apostasy. The sinful self-determination of Adam's will was both the cause of the first sin and the first sin itself. You can't push it back farther. That sinful determination of man himself was both the cause of the first sin, and the first sin itself. Let me just note again with you that in that Westminster Theological Journal review article of mine that you were assigned to read, Bernard Ramm and the Theology of Sin, my reference to the fact that theologians like Ramm and Birkhauer, quote, locate the mystery of sin at the wrong place, I was thinking of just this. You see, Birkhauer denies any concept of causality in connection with our relation to the first sin of Adam, thus denying that it was because Adam was our covenant representative head, and he sinned, that his sin was imputed to us. And I said that I think Birkhauer is clearly wrong in doing that, biblically. But again, you see, Birkhauer and Ramm introduce into their argument for that the fact that the first sin itself was causeless, in the sense that Duncan and Shedd used that term in these things that I've quoted. They use that as evidence for the denial of any causality in regard to the relation between Adam's first sin and our being reckoned sinners and having the same death in sin and corrupted nature conveyed to us. Westminster Confession 6:3. That's why I say they've put the mystery in the wrong place. I hope you understand that. If not, just meditate on that review article when you have more time. But that's what I mean when I say they put the mystery in the wrong place and thus confuse the issue. And my fear is confuse many of their readers. Well, I was quoting from Shedd there. He goes on to quote another, Julius Mueller, in his classic study of the doctrine of sin. I put the name there so you can write it down. There are these classic books that everybody has found so helpful afterwards in theology, like T.J. Crawford's book on the atonement that I'll refer to when we get into the Doctrine of Christ course. And here in regard to sin, the book by Julius Mueller on the doctrine of sin. Shedd quotes that in volume 2 from pages 173 to 175. Let me share that with you. We must acknowledge, Mueller writes, that evil is in its nature inconceivable and incomprehensible. That is to say, it is the product of arbitrariness. His German word there is Willkür, arbitrariness. That's what sin is. And arbitrariness is a violation of right reason and true sequence. The inexplicableness of evil is contained in the very conception of evil. The incomprehensibleness of its origin arises not so much from the limitations of our knowledge. The incomprehensibleness of sin's origin arises not so much from the limitations of our knowledge. If we just knew more. No. As from the nature of evil itself. Hence, its inexplicableness does not dwindle and disappear with the increase of our knowledge. And at no future stage of development and growth in wisdom do we pass from this incomprehensibleness to an insight into a higher necessity of evil. Because I'm sure he would say, if we ever pass to an understanding of some higher necessity of evil, rising above the dilemma again, to use Birkhauer's terms, then we would have made the evil less evil. If we could point to some way in which there's a necessity, then, of course, the evil would be less evil. Let me just maybe complete this, and I'll be at the end of this section, and we can take a deep breath. I would say, indeed, the very opposite is the case. And Mueller says that, too. He says, the purer our moral knowledge becomes, the more thoroughly do we perceive evil to be contrary to nature and to reason, and thoroughly unaccountable and groundless. Now let me say it one more time. Again, this problem, you see, like the others, presents a mystery which cannot be solved or fully understood by us. But, as I said on problem or mystery A, here also, we may avoid the mystery if we choose by denying one of the scriptural premises on which it rests. Maybe we'll go the Pelagian route, too often the Arminian route, by denying that Adam was created truly holy. He wasn't that good. Or maybe we'll go the other way and we'll deny that his sin was his own free, voluntary, uncoerced act. And maybe we'll say we've got to take the sovereignty of God seriously. And after all, whatever we're going to say after that, I don't know. But you see, that kind of solution is no solution at all. And so I have to stress at the end of this section what I stressed at the beginning of it, that the two truths that give rise to a mystery like this are the truths that light up our experience in all human history, so that, if I may put it this way, this is a mystery that doesn't puzzle or distress us, I hope, but rather reveals what we need to know in order that we might worship and serve our God aright. One place where I try to reflect upon that, by the way, is in the notes that I prepared for my debate, if you want to call it that, that's the way it was billed, with Dr. Richard Rice of Loma Linda University. Was held up at Biola in the fall of 1986, and I thought they might be of some use to you, so I made those available in the handout. They are not a transcript of the debate, you understand. The first part is because we each got a chance to make a presentation, so I had that written up. But the second part of that are just some things I wanted to have, kind of where I could take a quick peek at a scripture reference or whatever, knowing how I figured the discussion was going to go. And I thought they might be of some help to you. Gary, I guess, had the question. Yeah. Well, that's another one of the questions that I always had to make choices that I chose not to get into in class. The question of how do we relate the title of the tree to what has transpired? And I think Murray gets into this in the reading. You know, some will say that that refers to what man would have had he obeyed, a proper knowledge of good and evil. And others will say, no, it's a reference to that which he now experiences as a result of the fall. And Murray takes the position that it's a title which has reference to either eventuality, but of course it has a different character depending on the eventuality. He now has come to a knowledge of good and evil, but now he knows good as that which he has forfeited, and now he knows evil as that to which he has succumbed. So that when we read that this is a likeness to God, obviously we can't therefore conclude, oh, then this is a good thing. You know, we go the Mormon route and it's a fall upward. Strange doctrine. Obviously in the context, that's not what's being referred to. Perhaps some suggest there's even a certain irony, sarcasm in the way in which it's put. But certainly the knowledge of good and evil that he has is one that he has in a way that God doesn't have. He has the knowledge of evil, as I say, is that which he has succumbed to and now is enslaved to, and that's not the knowledge God has. Oh, there's that class. I knew they were around somewhere before we started praying. Expecting at least one other visitor who's scheduled to start his seminary studies in the fall with his wife, who said they were coming. Maybe they couldn't find room four, or maybe they're still with Packer. Packer hasn't finished, right? No, okay. Well, as sure you know, this is our last day together, so whatever's going to be said in class is going to be said today or never. There is no mañana, and I also have an eye on the fact that the tape is going. Is it going? And therefore, wouldn't be good to leave that up in the air either. So I hope you'll be sensitive to the fact that I have definite terminus in view. But we come now in the outline to another major heading, underlined, the doctrine of sin. It's not quite as bad as it seems that we've come to this doctrine with our last 3 hours now to go. Because we have, obviously, of necessity, said much regarding the biblical doctrine of sin already without being under that specific heading in the outline. For example, we've already considered important aspects of what is topic 2 on your outline now, the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity. We've talked about that, and you have Murray's book to study. What I want to do today is to lecture on topics 3, 4, and 5 under this heading, the doctrine of sin. May I just note a couple of things here? One thing is that the suggested reading in William Cunningham's book, Historical Theology, volume 1, chapter 20, that you see listed there for the topic total inability, is also the best treatment of the doctrine of free agency, I would say, of which I'm aware. And therefore, I would call that to your attention. You might want to put an arrow or something to note that that deals with the matter of free agency very well. I would urge you to write a memo to yourself to read it sometime. I know it won't probably be this month, but sometime. The readings in Murray and in Hookema, I believe, will be adequate to remind you of the Bible's teaching regarding the nature of sin. That's topic 1 here. So basically, I'm leaving you with the reading assignments there. I did not assign it, but Burkhoff also gives a helpful treatment, helpful especially because it's brief, of the matter of what is the nature of sin on pages 227 to 236 of Burkhoff's Systematic Theology. And his outline of the scriptural idea of sin is as follows here. And just share it with you so that you could compare that, perhaps, with what you're going to be reading in the assigned portions. Burkhoff discusses the nature of sin in terms of 6 points. Let me just explain for Michael that this is our last day, and we're just kind of putting some loose ends together first, and then we'll get into the 3 things that we're going to think about especially today. Burkhoff discusses the nature of sin as, first of all, a specific kind of evil. To speak of evil is a broader category that would include sickness, natural calamities, all those evils. But sin is a specific kind of evil, that it is a moral evil for which man is responsible. Secondly, sin has an absolute character. Moral neutrality is never possible for a moral agent. Thirdly, sin always has relation to God and His will. Thus it is that sin always has relation to God's law. And fourthly, sin includes both guilt and pollution. And therefore, the sinner needs both forgiveness, because of that guilt aspect of sin, and he needs cleansing and renewal. He needs justification and sanctification. And then Burkhoff's 5th heading is that sin has its seat in the heart. The heart, which is the center of man's being, of his thoughts and his will and his emotions. And then 6th and finally, that sin does not consist, as the Pelagian idea would have it, sin does not consist exclusively in overt, outward, shall we say, acts. Ta-da. And as I say, you have the assignments there under topic 1 also. And I want to talk about topics 3, 4, and 5 under the heading Doctrine of Sin today. Now, regarding topic 6, I fear that the traditional designation actual sin, still writing? Fine. That is slowing down. That heading might mislead some to talk about actual sin. Somebody might ask, do you mean that Adam's first sin imputed to me because he's my covenant head is not actually sin? And the depraved situation in which I find myself as a child of Adam is not actually sin? Of course, we don't mean that at all. And so I've chosen, rather than to use the title actual sin there under Romans 6, to talk about acts of sin. But I realize that that term can certainly be misunderstood also. It might seem to exclude thoughts and words, and we're not doing that either. Under that heading, we're simply thinking of all those sins that proceed now from the sinful heart. And on the reading assignment, you get a break there because the assignment is a chapter in Anthony Hukama that you're also assigned for topic one. Isn't it nice to run into that one time where you will already have read it by the time you get down there to the assignment on six? Your assignment with regard to subject seven on the doctrine of sin, the punishment of sin, is a section in Burkhoff. Now, as I've said, for topic two, the imputation of Adam's sin, which we've talked quite a bit about already, you are assigned that entire little but complex book by John Murray on the imputation of Adam's sin. And I think I said this the other day, but let me be sure that it has been said. Pay especially close attention to the false doctrine of mediate imputation. Mediate imputation. Because I'm not talking about it in class, okay? That's the doctrine associated with Joshua Placaeus of the school of Saumur in France back in the 17th century. Mediate imputation, also associated with certain New England theologians in the 18th century. Evidently not including Jonathan Edwards, at least according to Warfield and Murray. They think it's a false charge to say that Jonathan Edwards held to mediate imputation, though Charles Hodge and William Cunningham say that he did. I think Warfield and Murray are probably correct. And mediate imputation also associated with the New School Presbyterians in this country in the 19th century. Some who claim to hold to mediate imputation, like Samuel Hopkins, actually were denying the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity altogether, and that seems clearly to have been Placaeus' position. He talked about it in terms of mediate imputation, perhaps just to avoid more serious discipline. Now, the doctrine of mediate imputation teaches that the imputation of Adam's first sin to his posterity is mediated to us through the fact that we have inherited corruption of nature as those in relationship to Adam. And the reason why people like John Murray get so excited about that teaching and feel that it is so dangerous is the consequences that they fear will result then on the redemption side of the Adam Christ analogy that Paul, of course, institutes in Romans 5 and in 1 Corinthians 15. You see, what would be the implications of a doctrine of mediate imputation? Would that mean, then, that we are justified in Christ as a result of, perhaps somehow as a consequence or on the basis of, our receiving sanctification in Christ? Now that would go along with the Roman Catholic doctrine of justification, but would be contrary to not only the Protestant doctrine, but we believe the Pauline, the biblical doctrine of justification. If you held to this on the side of the imputation of Adam's sin to his posterity, that guilt, then either you have a significant asymmetry here, if you refuse that teaching that says justification is an outgrowth of sanctification, or you have to, or then perhaps you would fall into a very non-evangelical doctrine of justification. So I'm just urging you here to read those sections on mediate imputation carefully. Be sure that you could answer the question if you come to licensure exam. If somebody asks you, do you believe in mediate imputation or immediate imputation, and why? You may not think, as I said the other day, that that's the question on the cutting edge of hamartiology, the doctrine of sin. But believe me, based on experience, you may find somebody in your presbytery or classes who does and is ready to ask you about mediate imputation and why is it a serious error. Now, time is a-wasting, and I want to move on then to topic three, 4 and 5 on our outline under the doctrine of sin, and think a little bit about the doctrine of total depravity, and then total inability, then the very important also doctrine of free agency. Perhaps that's where your questions especially would come in. What I'm going to be trying to do is make sure we've said something about these issues, and we'll see where we stand as far as time remaining before 3 o'clock. You know, I'm always overly optimistic. It might be helpful to have your outline before you somewhere now, because it is fairly detailed and may keep you from taking some notes on matters that are already, at least briefly, noted there. You see, under our heading now, Roman numeral 3, total depravity, under the main heading, doctrine of sin, we want to look first of all at definition, and we'll call this capital A, definition. You'll find that that term, original sin, is the title that's often used at this point, but that designation, original sin, certainly seems to be ambiguous. Because in Reformed theology, original sin has been used in different ways. Sometimes that term, original sin, is used as the general term, including, as is indicated there on the transparency, both that first sin of Adam imputed to his posterity, that sin itself, and also the moral corruption, depravity of nature inherited by all Adam's descendants descending from him by natural generation. Sometimes it has been used in that sense as a cover term for both. Whereas other Reformed theologians have used it more specifically to refer only to that second matter of the hereditary depravity of all Adam's offspring. Let me give you examples of both usages. First of all, example of the broader reference of the term original sin would be the Westminster Shorter Catechism answer to question 18. The question 18 says, wherein consists the sinfulness of that estate whereinto man fell? And the answer comes, the sinfulness of that estate whereinto man fell consists in the guilt of Adam's first sin, the want or the lack of original righteousness, and the corruption of his whole nature, which is commonly called original sin. And the way the sentence is constructed, I think that reference, which is commonly called original sin, goes back to all three of those matters. Adam's first sin, imputed to us, the lack of original righteousness, and the corruption. And the sentence ends, together with all actual transgressions which proceed from it. It's the narrower reference, however, that has come to be the more common one, and that's the one you find in A.A. Hodge, his Outlines of Theology, where he says, on page 322, more strictly, however, the phrase original sin designates only the hereditary moral corruption common to all men from birth. Let me just say as a footnote, parenthetically, that maybe you would have thought that the term original sin would seem to be especially suitable to refer only to that first sin of Adam imputed to his posterity. But to my knowledge, that has not been a usage in Reformed theology. It has either referred to both these aspects or to the second matter of depravity, not, for whatever interesting reason, to the first. Now, just note in passing that when Hodge uses that phrase, which I've chosen not to use here, original sin, and I'm not using it simply because of the ambiguity, when Hodge chooses to use that term, it's helpful to see that that term, original, looks perhaps in three directions at the same time. On that moral depravity and corruption now native to man since the fall, the fact that Adam's fall not only made us guilty for that sin, which is what we've talked about earlier, but also now made us sinners. And since, as I say, the term original sin sometimes is used in a broader sense, I've chosen to use the very familiar term now, total depravity. So on your outline now, we're at Arabic 2, to look at that designation, total depravity.